Ramon squinted, straining, trying to see as far off in the distance as he could. What he saw wasn't exactly what's in the picture, not that you can see it, but it was very similar to what's in the picture. If you turn around, you can see a little bit clearer in the back there. He was trying to see the very farthest mountain range. Just that afternoon, he and his companions were on a trek through the Taubwe territory. They were trying to get as deep into the mountains as they could, looking for a spot that would allow us, a village that would allow us to come in and work with them. And he thought he had seen a place. He thought he had seen the place that God had shown him in a dream about 8 years before when we first started thinking about trying to reach the Taubwe. But he wasn't really sure if it really was the place. And we had met with so much opposition, so much resistance, that he was beginning to wonder if this really was God's will. But now he strained again, trying to see if that really was the place. And as he did, as if to answer his questions, a hand came down out of heaven, and a finger pointed to the very place that he had seen that afternoon. Peace filled his heart, and he was sure now that this really was the place that God had shown him so long ago, that we should start the work, and also that God still was with us, that we were still doing the work that he was asking us to do. But there were so many, you can see there are so many mountain ranges, so many hills between us and them, and those hills are full of people. We're full of people who were actively trying to keep us away from the Taubwe. So he strained, trying to see what God's intention was as to how we would get across all these obstacles and finally reach the place God intended us to be. But before he could see, the dream faded, and he woke up again to the reality of the crinkly banana leaves under them and the rain dripping through the trees onto their faces and the leeches drinking their blood and staining their sheets. But that peace was still with him. He still knew that the place he had seen that afternoon was the place that God had shown him all those years ago, and that we were on the right path. I think every one of you here knows that in September of 2011, that's right, September of 2011, I launched to the Philippines to begin a new church planting project among the Taubwe with Adventist Frontier Missions. When I arrived there, I expected that, you know, within a few weeks maybe at the most, that I'd be able to get into the Taubwe people, that I'd find a village that would be interested in me coming in and helping them with medical care and other things, and that I would be able to begin working. But when I got there, I found that the people had done everything in their power to keep out outsiders, not just white people, but anybody from the outside. I launched to the village where I grew up, which is in the next tribe north, the Alangan tribe. I started out there, and I enlisted the church leaders that my parents helped to raise up. I enlisted them to help me to get into the Taubwe, and as we started visiting Taubwe territory, we found that they had actually paid people from the Alangan tribe, the tribe where I grew up. They pay them to guard all the trailheads into their territory, and they pay them very well every year in highland rice, which is very valuable, and then to ensure their loyalty, they blackmail them. You see, the Taubwe are very, very powerful spiritually with the demons. With the people, first of all, everyone in the tribe is very, very afraid of what the demons can do to them. And so anything that you're afraid of, you are in subjection to. You put yourself under whatever you're afraid of. So first of all, they're under Satan because they're afraid of him. And then on top of that, a large portion of the Taubwe are shamans. So shamans actively try to use the demons' power for their own good. In reality, the demons are using them, are enslaving them, but many times they will do things for them in order to try to convince them that they are working for them. And because they have put themselves so much under Satan's power, he does things for them, but most often to them, that here in the States sometimes we'd have a hard time believing. So when the Taubwe blackmail these guards into not allowing anyone into the territory, they're very serious, and they will kill them if they don't keep their promise. The Taubwe are not physically violent. They would almost never touch you with their hands, but they will try to kill anyone who crosses them through the demons, through the power of the spirits. So when I arrived among there and started working among them, I found them to be very, very resistant. When we would go and try to talk with them, if we ever could find them, usually they would just keep on staring at the trail and just keep on walking. They wouldn't look up at us. They wouldn't make eye contact with us. They wouldn't answer us when we talked to them. We figured out pretty early that if we asked for directions and they answered us, you would always want to do the opposite of whatever they told you. Because they actually maintain trails in their territory. They maintain trails that loop back on themselves and end you back where you started from. And the trails that aren't maintained, those are the ones they actually use. So you would always want to take the opposite of what they told you and the less used trail. They would do everything in their power to keep us out. And so that's when the waiting began. Growing up, I had read through the Bible, and I found text after text in the Bible that talked about waiting on the Lord. It's a theme in the Bible, to wait on the Lord, especially in the Old Testament. And I had read all those texts growing up, and I thought I understood them, but I had never really had to practice it until I went to the Talmud and started trying to reach them. And so as I was waiting, and as I heard God telling me to wait patiently for him, I decided I would start, I would do a little research and read some of those texts again, or all of those texts again. And I found something interesting. In almost every text in the Bible where God tells us to wait, if you back up a few texts, it always talks about some human weakness, either in the speaker or in other people. For example, here in Psalm 130, verse 3, there are many more, but I just picked a couple. Psalm 130, verse 3, if you, O Lord, kept a record of sins, O Lord, who could stand? This is referring to weakness in my own heart. And then a few verses later, I wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word, I put my hope. Then in Lamentations 3:19, just a few verses before our scripture reading, I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. And then a few verses later, it is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Psalm 27, the second half of verse 12, false witnesses rise up against me, breathing out violence. So this is referring to wickedness around us and other people. And then in verse 14, wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. So when I read these things, I said, well, maybe there's something in me that God still needs to work on. Maybe my training isn't done, and part of my training cannot be accomplished until I actually arrive here and start actually doing the work. So I need to work on that as much as possible. But then I also, as I was reading through the Bible on the theme of waiting, I also noticed that whenever God told people to wait, they never just sat on their rears twiddling their thumbs. They always kept busy. You know, David waited for God to take care of the problem of Saul, but he didn't just sit around and wait. You know, he made some mistakes, yes, but he did a lot of good too. He protected a lot of people. He kept Israel's borders intact. He protected the shepherds like Nabal. He did a lot of good things while he was waiting for God to take care of the problem of Saul. Then you have the disciples at Pentecost. Jesus told them to wait in Jerusalem until the Spirit came on them, but they didn't just sit there doing nothing. They worked out their differences. They got into unity. They prayed. They were working. They were doing what they could while they waited for God. And then, of course, the ultimate expression of waiting post-Calvary is us waiting for Jesus to come back again. And God has given us the most noble work that any human could ever have while we wait for Jesus to come back. And that's in the Great Commission when he tells us to work to bring other people to Christ, to reach the world with the good news of salvation. And so I decided, well, while I'm waiting, I'll do everything that I can. And the first thing was to explore the Talmud territory. And so that's where the story came from that I started out with. Me and Ramon, who's the main leader among the Alangan churches, and several other of the church leaders, started going and visiting Talmud territory. And we went to all the border villages. We walked all the way from one end of the territory to the other. We had meetings with village leaders, with tribal leaders. And that one particular expedition, we went as deep in the mountains as we could. We just tried to go as far as we could until we met with so much resistance that we couldn't go any farther. And after about six months of waiting and actively working as hard as we could, God finally opened the doors into the village of Balangabung. Now, Balangabung is not in the heart of the territory. It's on the border of the territory. They are Taubwid, but they're people that are willing to have interactions with outsiders. So they're willing to speak the trade language of Tagalog. They're willing to wear Western clothes and to eat some Western food. But they still speak the same language and have much of the same culture it's still intact. In fact, most of them have brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers that are still in the highlands. And when I arrived in the village of Balangabung, I found out why God wanted me there. There actually was a small group of Adventist believers there, and I didn't know this before I got there. About 30 years back, a Filipino lady, because this is on the border area, so they're right next to where the Filipinos are, a Filipino lady had moved and bought a farm near the village of Balangabung. And every Sabbath, she was an Adventist, and every Sabbath, she would cook a pot of rice and kill a chicken. And she would invite everyone from Balangabung to come down and eat with her. And after about 12, 15 years of doing that, she was finally able to baptize a number of these people. The problem was that, well, first of all, she was a good, honest Adventist Christian, but she didn't really know how to lead other people and to establish a church. So she taught them everything that she knew, which is primarily the how to hold a church service. But then she also died not too long after that, and this group of believers were left on their own. So what happened? They never really came to know Jesus. What happened is they just replaced the spirits and chanting and killing chickens and whatnot to appease the spirits. They replaced all that with God and going to church and singing the right songs, doing everything in the exact right order. They replaced that with manipulating, you know, they used that to manipulate God instead of the other things to manipulate the spirits. They never really knew Christ. They had all kinds of strange ideas when I first got there. And in fact, they considered me a heretic for quite a while, because I didn't do things exactly the way that they did them. It took a couple years to gain their trust and to work through that. So when I got there, I thought, you know, now my work is going to begin. Now I'm going to be able to actually reach unreached peoples. And I found that everyone in the village was already a Christian, and I still couldn't get any farther. They wouldn't let me, you know, I figured I would learn the language there and maybe move on into the interior. They wouldn't let me up. Some Highlanders came through and started coming to me for medical treatment. And the Highlander elders got word of that, and they shut that off completely. So for two and a half years, I had almost no contact with any unreached people. The only thing I could do was, again, wait on the Lord. And again, I tried to keep busy, do as much as I could, be as useful as possible while I was waiting. The first order of business, of course, was to build a house. This picture is actually version number 2. The first one collapsed after about a year and a half. Native materials don't last very long. This one's a little bit more sturdy, have big old hardwood posts. And the major improvement, you can see there on the left, there's a bathroom. There's actually a concrete slab with a toilet bowl on it. The only problem is when there's no water, you can't flush it. So you still have to run to the jungle when there's no water. And there have been walls put on it since this picture was taken. No fear. Fear not. So I built a house. And then another thing that I did in that those couple of years of waiting was to start some livelihood projects. This is a picture of a rubber plantation. This is a nursery where I started the rubber seedlings. The people there for thousands of years have been hunter-gatherers. They would do a little bit of agriculture, but it was only for extra special food, you know, your comfort food. There was always food enough in the jungle. They all just had to go out every day and get whatever food they needed for that day. So they never had any, they never developed any idea of how to save or conserve or plan for the future. You know, most of our ancestors had winter and have had winter for thousands of years. If you didn't prepare well enough, then you died. And so we have a culture of saving and preparing, but they never had that. And after 20-some years between my parents and I of trying to teach them to conserve and to budget, it still hasn't happened yet. So I figured that I should try a different approach. And so I did a lot of research, and one of the things I found was rubber. Rubber can grow. Another problem is that they're pushed. Immigrants have come in and have taken over the lowlands, the flatlands. They've been pushed up into the mountains where they're not as good. They don't know agriculture in the mountains as well. There's a lot of deforestation. There's just too many people living on that land to support it. And they don't know how to really utilize that steep grade very well. So I'm wanting to bring in rubber, which will help reverse deforestation, help prevent erosion. And the great thing about it is it's a cash crop that you can harvest every 15 days. So it'll provide money for them to buy supplemental food when their agriculture doesn't provide enough, to put their kids through school. They're wanting to start educating their kids, and to buy medicines. It's very important. So that's one of the things I did. Last year, the Carolina Conference gave us enough money to purchase a well drill. This is just a home-built well drill that was made there in the Philippines. And we're starting to drill wells. We hit water here next to my house at 130 feet. We've been having a little bit of trouble getting the water out, but there is water down there, so we have hope. Probably what I've spent the most time doing, though, and what has helped to gain the people's trust more than anything else is the medical work. This is a man. While I was on furlough in 2013, he cut his knee open with a machete, and it was a pretty bad wound, so he decided to go ahead and make the day's trip down to the nearest hospital, and the doctor sutured him up. And then he came back, and in the prescribed 15 days, he took the external sutures out, but it just kept on festering. The wound just kept on festering and festering and festering. Well, he didn't want to go back to that doctor. So he waited until I came back and came to me and didn't tell me what had happened. So I tried to treat it, thinking it was just infected, and it just wouldn't heal up. So finally, I decided I needed to figure out what was going on here. So I cut his knee open again and found out that the doctor had put in internal nylon sutures, non-absorbable sutures, as well as external ones. And so I had to, you know, cut his knee open and take all those old sutures out and then suture back up again. Kind of gained me a reputation among the people for being better than the local healthcare. It's not always true, but sometimes I wonder. There's also another case of a man ran into my house, you know, just dripping with rain. It was a hurricane, middle of a hurricane. The rivers were up. We couldn't get out. And his kid had just drank like a Campbell's soup can full of kerosene. And had burped it up into his lungs. He was having a really, really hard time breathing. I don't think he would have made it. We couldn't have gotten him out to the hospital anyway. Thankfully, my cousin had given me some drugs that I was able to use to help his breathing, and then push charcoal down him as fast as I could. And he recovered. And this is just a couple of stories, but there are a number of people who would be dead today if I hadn't been there. And it's a wonderful thing, and it's very fulfilling. But I was still asking myself, God, is this really what you called me here to do? This is great, but am I just making healthy sinners? You know, one of my professors always used to say, you don't want to just make healthy sinners. You need to lead people to Christ. I forgot one more thing. In 2013 also, a family friend taught me to pull teeth, and my dentistry has almost become more popular now than my medical work. It's actually a lot of fun. I couldn't imagine how much fun pulling teeth is. It's really an upper body workout, but it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. I've pulled about 50 teeth this year. The biggest thing, though, that I've done, the central thing that I've done, though, is to work with that church, the church that was there in Balangabong, and try to bring them back to a foundation of Christ. Try to help them to know Jesus as their Savior, as their friend. Try to help them understand that you can't manipulate God. You can't push his buttons and get something out of a vending machine. That he does things for us. He's more powerful than the spirits. But it's out of a relationship with him. And that's taken a lot of time. I found that it's much harder to bring someone to a relationship with Christ than to just teach them the right ways to do things. Which is what's so much easier to do, and so often happens in this line of work. But after about 2 years, 2.5 years, just about the time that I was starting to gain their trust, and these projects were coming to fruition, just about that time, some of my church members finally started to get the vision, finally started to understand. A lot of them still don't, but there's a core now of people who I really believe do love Jesus and have a relationship with him and understand that we're saved through faith in him, not by singing the right songs at the right time in church. And just about the time that those people are excited about reaching their people, excited about bringing the gospel to the Highlanders who still don't know about him. So just about the time that this started to happen, God finally started to open the doors. And we ran across Benson. Benson, I had actually first met him about just after I moved into the village of Balangabong, so about 2 years before. He had had spinal TB for 4 years. His spine had gotten so spongy because of the TB eating it up that it started to collapse. So he has a big hunchback, and he had been jumping from shaman to shaman trying to get treated, and he had come to a shaman nearby, and he'd heard about my skill with medicine, so he asked me to come treat him. So I went down and assessed him and figured out what was the matter with him, and told him the bad news was that he would always have the hunchback. There's no way that we could treat that. but that we could treat the actual disease, that he wouldn't die, and that there was a good chance he would recover his ability to walk. He was paralyzed at this point. And when I told him that, I saw hope come into his eyes. It looked like it was the first hope that he had had in all those years. You know, the Highlanders, the shaman do some pretty terrible things. They besides just killing people, they'll usually it's old men that have the spiritual power. So they'll go and they'll find a young bride, and they will steal that bride from her husband. If her husband doesn't give him his wife, then they'll kill that the husband and take the wife anyway. They'll never marry young unmarried people. They always take someone else's bride in order to exert their power. And the same thing with pigs and chickens and pots and anything else they want. They'll use witchcraft to steal it. And it's really a horrible life. You know, anthropologists sometimes ask me if I'm, you know, why I'm trying to change people, why they're better off before I brought Westernism to them. But they're really miserable, and they're living in fear, in terror most of the time. And so when Benson heard me tell him that I could help him, he understood that I wasn't just telling him that when he was coming to me for medicine, he wasn't just coming for medicine, wasn't just coming for treatment of his physical disease. They understand that when they come to me for medicine, they're also trying God. They understand that God gave us Western medicine, that God taught us how to use it, and that this is that the power still comes from him. And so when they come to ask me for treatment, they're trying God too. And I could just see the hope coming back into his eyes, hope that finally he could find relief from this disease, but also from the fear and the terror that he lived with all the time. Well, he was paralyzed and he couldn't walk. I have a water buffalo back at home. And so I told him the next day I would come back with my water buffalo and he could ride my water buffalo home. I should have done something. I should have made a way. I should have just carried him out on my back. But I wasn't thinking, and the next day when I came back, his shaman was there. And he was mad. He sat there and yelled at us straight for about half an hour. Finally, I decided it wasn't going to let up, so I just ignored him and walked over to Benson and started talking to him. And I told him that he could still come and that God would protect him from the curses that the shaman would for sure put on him, that God could keep him from dying a horrible death from the demons. But he didn't know God well enough. He just had not experienced God yet, didn't trust him enough to protect him. And I could already see his eyes were dull and glazed over. He had already given up hope. And there was nothing that I could do. I told him if ever he changed his mind, I was always there waiting for him. And then I left. Well, it was about 2 years later that the church started turning around, that you know, I got that core of people who really understood and got on fire for reaching their people. When Benson showed up again, he had arrived, he moved to another shaman, and this shaman had five other people besides him who were all dying of either measles or tuberculosis. And the shaman finally threw up his hands and said, I can't handle this. And he called me and asked to turn over all of his patients to me, including Benson. So I made sure that the sun didn't go down before Benson was moved to our village, to one of my members' houses. I treated all of those patients. They all recovered. Except for the shaman itself, he was kind of trying to play with God, and he never did recover. Finally had to kind of wipe the dust off our feet and move on with him. But Benson moved to our village, and we started treating him. It took a long time. Spinal TB, it takes even longer than normal TB for the medicines to start working and the spine to start rebuilding. He was starting to get pretty discouraged at one point. He was still in a lot of pain, still paralyzed. He could still feel a little bit if you touched him, but he couldn't move, and he was getting 2.5-3 months into it, and he still hadn't noticed any improvement. But he had developed this big abscess over his spine, and I'd been trained to open abscesses, but actually I had never done it before. He was my first, and I definitely hadn't been trained to do it over the spine. I wasn't sure if that was okay or not. My supervisor, though, when he was there, I took him back to Manila, the capital, and he got me on the phone with an orthopedic surgeon who talked me through it. So I came back, and I opened up his back and drained all that pus out. And instantly, his pain was relieved, his paralysis was relieved. The orthopedic surgeon told me to keep the weight, you know, keep him with canes or crutches or something to keep the weight off his spine. I couldn't keep him contained. The next morning, I looked out under my eaves, and here he is on the roof of his neighbor's house, drying bamboo to make a basket. He was just so happy and so excited. But even more than that, you know, every day any of my TB patients, every day I will take the medicine to them, deliver it personally to make sure that they're compliant. And every day when I did that, I would tell them a Bible story, you know, starting from the very beginning of the great controversy. For them, it makes more sense to understand what happened, you know, before creation even, to understand the war in heaven and working on through creation, because that explains to them where the spirits came from and why they are living in such a terrible world, such a painful world. So I started, you know, at the very beginning and worked all the way through. And he has come to faith in Christ. He's still a little bit nervous about the whole idea of baptism. That kind of scares him. But he has declared his faith in Christ and that he wants to go to heaven. God has actually given him dreams indicating that he wants, that God wants to use him in his work to reach the Taobuin. He's our very first Thailand convert. You know, the two tribes, the Alangan where I grew up and the Taobui, were very excited when I got the two tribes together. They had been living next to each other for thousands of years. We have records going back before Christ of the people being there. But they didn't really have a whole lot of interactions with each other. But each tribe, they're a small enough tribe that everyone tends to be related to everyone else. And it's very hard for them to find spouses for their kids. So the two tribes were really excited when I got them together, and there's a whole new gene pool opened up for them to find spouses for their kids. So one of my members one day, just a young lady, just up and disappeared. And we didn't hear back from her for about 6 months. And then she one day showed up in our village with a husband in tow from Alangan territory. He was from a village that I hadn't really spent a whole lot of time with. I didn't know him. So we talked a little bit, but he was shy, and I tend to be kind of shy too. And we didn't really talk a whole lot. But about that time, just about the same time that Benson was coming to faith, a number of other people were wanting to become Christians. And so I started holding a series of baptismal studies, and I invited anyone else who was interested in the village to come, or anyone at all, to come and to attend those studies. And who should show up but this young man, whose name was Angelo, by the way. Angelo showed up to these studies, and he showed up every single night. He was more faithful than any of my other students. He would come early, and one night when he came early, and I also came early, we started talking a little bit. And he said, after a little while, he said, "You know, you saved my life when I was just a baby." I said, "Really? I don't remember ever having met you before." And it turns out, back when I was in late elementary school, so 12, 13, somewhere around there, my dad was starting to supervise, AFM's missionaries around Asia. So they had to travel quite a bit, sometimes a month at a time, and they would leave me with my adopted family there. And I would run the clinic. Mom had already started to teach me. I would run the clinic as best as I could. So Angelo was brought by his parents when he was just a baby. He was dying. I'm pretty sure it was pneumonia and malaria. And my mom wasn't there, so I cracked open the books and treated him as best I could. And they took the medicine and went home, and I never heard back from him again. Turns out that he recovered. I saved his life. And all those years growing up, his parents kept telling him the story of how I had saved his life. And he always knew, he didn't tell anybody, but in his heart, he made a promise that if ever he could find me, that he would become whatever it is that I am. So all these years later, it was about 15 years later, I moved to another tribe, another place. He marries, which gets the two tribes together, which inspires this girl to go back to Alangan territory, marry him, and bring him back to the village where I'm living in. God puts all these things together, you know, 15 years later, and he meets me and attended very faithfully all those studies. And then in Alangan camp meeting, or the native camp meeting, last April, Angelo was baptized. There's another village nearby, just the next village over, that is a completely non-Christian village. Nobody there is a Christian. They've been very, very resistant to the gospel. And I don't know what happened, other than that God must have been working on their hearts. But suddenly they decided they were going to let us come in and start working with them, start teaching them. Up to this point, my members hadn't been interested in doing Bible studies, hadn't been interested in really reaching out, especially not me teaching them to do so. But suddenly when this village started to open up, suddenly my members were interested too. And the first week I had three people who wanted to do Bible studies. And so I gave them the Bible studies and walked them through it, you know, gave them some pointers, and they went and held Bible studies with three families in that village. The next week, I had eight people who wanted to do Bible studies. And the following week, I had 16. Before it was done with, every family in that village, except for one, except for the captain, had been having Bible studies done with them. And a number of the people were getting really excited, and they wanted to hear more. And so they actually invited us to come hold a series of meetings. And I was wanting to keep it more Bible studies, but my church really, really wanted to do meetings too. And so I agreed, and the idea was team teach. I would preach one week or one night, and one of the church members would teach one night, and I would mentor them through that process. And so we started holding these meetings, and a lot of people got really interested. The very first, and there were some manifestations of God's power too. The first night, there was a lady, who's the wife of the local shaman, one of the local shamans, the more powerful one. She was sitting in the back, and she was just laughing and making fun of me as I was talking about God's word. One of the ladies sitting next to her said, "You need to be careful. This is God that he's talking about, and this is God's word. This is serious stuff." She didn't pay any attention. She kept on laughing and making fun. Well, in a couple of hours, she started just vomiting up blood, vomiting and vomiting and vomiting blood, and she would not come to me for treatment, did not want to have anything to do with me. She did live, but she was over a week in the hospital before she finally made it back. It was very, very weak. And the people saw that, and people recognized that God was allowing things to happen to show his power and to show that he wasn't to be messed with and that the spirits were not the best option. But as people started to get interested, the opposition also started to develop too. People, the village elders got really upset at us and started putting a lot of pressure on their members to stay away and to not have anything to do with us. We had 13 people decided that they wanted to become Christians, but they had to tell us secretly. They couldn't openly declare their faith because the village was tightening down on them so much, was oppressing them. And so when we finished the meetings, the village elders told us to get out and to stay out. We had our say. Turns out that they had thought that their members were so immune to anything Christian that there was no chance that anyone would want to convert. And when they saw that there were people actually changing and wanting something better, they felt threatened. So they kicked us out, told us not to come back, not to have anything to do with their members. And so we got down on our knees and we said, "Lord, what are we going to do? We have these 13 people who want to become Christians, and we can't get back to teach them and to lead them, to disciple them. What are we going to do?" Well, it was about a week that we kept on praying and praying and praying. And finally, one of my members, his daughter, has a disease that couldn't be treated at the time. She had been sick for over a year. And so he went to the village chief, and he asked, "You know, can I move my daughter here to give her a change of scenery and to try some herbal remedies that my in-laws here, who live here, know? And just like to help my daughter if I can." And the captain said, "Oh, yeah, sure, come on in, no problem, move here. But don't do any evangelism. Don't be going out, you know, house to house, doing Bible studies and trying to make people Christians." And so he came to me. His name was Sandy. He came to me. He said, "You know, good news, we got into the village, but the bad news is they won't let us do anything. What can I do?" And I said, "Don't worry about it. Just move there. And, you know, all the houses there, the walls are made out of bamboo. You can hear everything that happens in anyone's house. I said, just go ahead and move there. They can't stop you from worshiping in your own house. So morning and evening, hold worship in your house and sing your heart out. Sing as loud as you can, and everyone in the village will be able to hear you. And they can't stop you because they've given you permission to live there. And you have the freedom of religion in the Philippines. And so just sing your heart out, and the people whom God is calling, he will bring to you." And that happened actually just before I came back on furlough. And already there were two families that were worshiping with him every Sabbath. I told him the same thing on Sabbath, just hold worship services in your house and sing your heart out. There are already two families, and I've heard since, I've only been able to contact them once, but I've heard since that there are more people and they continue to worship. So this is our very first church plant among the Taobuid. These are some of the other baptisms, other Taobuid that were baptized. I don't have time to tell all the stories. You know, God told me to wait. He made me wait for about 2.5 years before he finally started to open the doors. I know one of the reasons was I did need change. I did need to develop. God was continuing to educate me, to teach me, to train me through this whole process. I also know, though, that there were other people that he was waiting on, that he was wanting to work through, with and through my church members, and he was waiting for them to be ready and to be open. But God's timing is perfect. You know, I think of Angelo. All those years later, 15 years later, after the seed was planted, before God finally brought us both to a different, totally different location so that we could meet and that seed could germinate and start to bear fruit. I don't know about you, how is it with you? Have you planted seeds for years and wondered why you didn't see results? You know, God promised in his word in Psalm 37 and verse 7, Psalm 130, verse 5. He says, I will wait for the Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. And he has promised that his word will not come back to him empty. Sometimes we wait years and years for those seeds to germinate, but in God's good time, they will bear fruit, because he has promised, and God doesn't lie. So wait patiently for the Lord. Maybe it's not that. Maybe it's a family member of yours. I remember my grandparents on my mom's side, they were hurt in the church pretty early on before I was ever around. And we prayed for them all of my life, all growing up, we prayed for them. And it wasn't until just a few years before they died that they finally reconciled with God and with the church and came to peace and to relationship with God. Sometimes it takes a long time. God isn't in a hurry. And he says, wait patiently for him. Maybe it's your own life. Maybe it's your own spiritual life that seems dry, seems that you haven't heard or felt God speaking to you in a long time. And God has told you, wait patiently for him. And he has also said, seek him with all your heart. As you seek for him with all your heart and you wait patiently for him, he will come to you. He will be with you. He has commanded us in Psalm 37, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Thank you.